Now, in truth, when Rabbi Zaitchik asked me to choose a topic, you know, I don't know the topic that's a good topic to speak, so I figured that Rabbi Zaitchik knows all the topics, and he chose this particular topic, which any topic is a good topic to speak to this group, because this is a group, Rabbi Zaitchik's group is a group, the JEP, are people who just, I think they have a very vast interest in terms of what they would like to know, and I think that they already have a tremendous amount of knowledge that they've already amassed over the years. And any time Abe is here, I know he knows whatever I know and then more. So it's always very, very daunting. And it's just a great honor to be with the JEP and with Rabbi Zaitchik and the people who are in his periphery. So let's talk about Jewish unity. And there are different ways. It's a difficult topic. I have exactly 50 minutes. I just used up two. I have 48 minutes left. It's a very large topic, a very daunting topic, and you can speak about it from many different perspectives. So I have chosen only one perspective to speak about it from. And just a little background, I think, is very important, just in terms of the framework of the topic. Because you can speak about Jewish unity within small groups, within a family. Let's say the husband is Sephardic and the wife is Ashkenazi. So then you're going to have certain kinds of conflicts, especially Pesach time and holiday time, and whenever you have major life events, because things do, you can speak about disunity and unity there between you can speak about it more globally between Hasidim and non-Hasidim. But I wanted to speak about it just from the perspective that it's a great challenge, and there doesn't seem to be any apparent solution to the challenge. So let's talk about it. So it's just a little background information, a little history, I think is important. And I think that the problem that we face, and that I'm going to speak about, which is a very acute problem, really only began about 250 years ago, not before. While we always knew that Jews picked a good fight, but it's not the level that we're speaking about this evening. And it was an issue that first started to exist, and it created a tremendous amount of strife and a tremendous amount of consternation in the world of the Jews. And that was the Reform Movement that took place at the end of the 18th century in Germany, which was one country. It had to do with the inner zeitgeist of Western Europe, with the emancipation and with the Age of Reason and Frederick II doing experiments that maybe, like Eliza Doolittle, you can teach Jews to be semi-human, which was the experiment that he did with Moses Mendelssohn. And then the Jews gained entree into German society, which was the first time since the destruction of the Second Temple the Jews were given that kind of an opportunity. And immediately Jews began to convert to Christianity, and Jews began to divest themselves to the best of their ability, divest themselves of their Judaism. So the Reform Movement, in all fairness, it began to try to plug that hole of losing Jews. So if Jews are becoming Protestant, let's see if we can reform Judaism and make it more Protestant, make it more Lutheran. And that's exactly what they attempted to do. Most people are not aware of the fact that one of the first things that they did was they changed Shabbos from Saturday to Sunday. And that lasted for many, many years. It turned back. As a matter of fact, in Pittsburgh, I think the oldest Reformed temple in all of the United States, which is in Pittsburgh, I believe they still celebrate Shabbos on Sunday, if it still exists. And they got rid of circumcision, because no Gentile, no Protestant, no Lutheran was circumcised. And they got rid of many of the things. They changed the synagogue, and the synagogue became exactly the same as a Lutheran church. And they introduced many changes. They abandoned many ritual laws without getting involved in the Reform movement, which is a lecture in itself. They followed Abraham Geiger's lead, which was basically, they followed what they call prophetic Judaism, which is all of the rituals are no longer of any value. They're part of a barbaric past of the early Israelites, and social justice and ethics and morality, which were taught to the Jews by the prophets. That is the real Judaism, the authentic Judaism, and they were going to continue that and abandon all of rabbinic Judaism and all of the rituals of biblical Judaism. And they abandoned that. They changed the marriage laws and the divorce laws to com- comply with the laws that they had in Germany at the time. So that it created, it wreaked havoc in Jewish families, because the mother was not reformed, the father was reformed, the grandmother was reformed, the grandchild was not. So then in one family, you had all of these issues. Then in the 20th century, another breach that took place was the rise of conservative Judaism. Conservative Judaism is basically, it's attributable to the Wissenschaft der Judentum, which was a science of Judaism movement in Germany in the late 19th century, early 20th century, but be that as it may, conservative Judaism is really an American invention. And they also changed many things in Judaism, as did the rise of the Reconstructionism, basic changes that they also promulgated. And that really created a tremendous amount of disunity among the Jewish people. And then, of course, the aftermath of the Reform Movement and the Conservative Movement gave rise to secular Jews and to assimilationist Jews. As we know, many Jews changed the name. Madeleine Albright, she even spoke about hell for the first time in her life just a few days ago. But Madeleine Albright said she didn't even know she was Jewish until far into her career, because people just divested themselves of their Judaism. It's no longer relevant. As a matter of fact, it was relevant not to be Jewish. We also know that when the State of Israel first came into being, these same issues of disunity were also raised. As a matter of fact, we know if you read David Ben-Gurion's diary, you know that there was a major fight about introducing anything Jewish in the State of Israel, because the original framers of the Constitution didn't want to have anything to do with Judaism, of traditional Judaism at all. They were already far beyond even the Reform Movement. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that there was a major debate in the early Knesset about even writing God in the Declaration of Independence. And they compromised to put in Tzur Yisrael, to put in the Rock of Israel. Because what's the Rock of Israel? Depends on your perspective. If you believe in God, God's the Rock of Israel. If you don't believe in God, so then we have a lot of mountains. A lot of mountains here in Israel. A lot of good rock, a lot of good Jerusalem stone. That's what it means. It was a major debate, a major dispute. We also know that Ben-Gurion, he writes again in his diary, that in order to have a unity government, he had to make major concessions. What were his major concessions? That the government would keep the Shabbos, and that all governmental agencies, when they would serve food, including the army, would have kosher food. And Ben-Gurion tells you why he did it. He says, I was assailed by all of my colleagues. That's the worst kind of a deal to make. Shabbos? My God. And kosher food? No lobster? No pork? Why'd you do that? And he writes, because traditional Torah Judaism will disappear within 25 years. It's an impossibility in this modern state. This is back there in 47. In this modern state, it's an impossibility that traditional Torah Jews, they're a fossilized, Toynbee even said it. It's just a fossilized religion. It's not going to exist. So he made all of those so that the gap between Torah Jews, I'm just going to call them Torah Jews. I hope that's everybody's okay. Some people say Torah true, some people say traditional, observant. All of them are wonderful phrases. I just like Torah Jew. It makes me feel warm and fuzzy. Torah Jew. I like the phrase. Okay. Now, in America, no, none of you are old enough to remember. Even I don't think I'm old enough to remember, but if you read that in the late 1940s and the early 1950s, most of the synagogues in America were Orthodox, because Jews came from Eastern Europe and they popped up all over the place. I know my great uncle was a rabbi in Shelby, Mississippi. I know I have a cousin who was a rabbi in Cheyenne, Wyoming. So there were Jews every place. And slowly in the late 40s and basically in the 50s, all of those Orthodox synagogues the board of directors voted for them to become conservative. There was a major debate. There were a few, I'm using up my time not judiciously. There's a lot of interesting stories that bring out the point. In Mount St. Clemens in Michigan.
We're using Central Time, by the way, so you have it.
Oh, really? I don't think so. No, I'm gonna keep it to what you said.
Almost late anyway.
I'm gonna keep it to 15 minutes. I can just stop talking fast. In Mount St. Clements in Michigan, there was a major suit between, we know his name was Baruch Litvin, and he sued the board of directors. The board of directors said, okay, we are removing the mechitza from the shul. That's it. They voted, we're removing the mechitza from the shul. So one of the members of the board said, you can't do that. We're incorporated as an Orthodox synagogue. And they said, okay. They went to their lawyers, and the lawyers did the research, and they said, you know, where does it say that Orthodox synagogue has to have a mechitza? And they had a major suit and went to the state Supreme Court, and they had to have affidavits. Rabbi Soloveitchik sent in an affidavit. Norman Lamb sent in an affidavit. Even from Israel, they had the Rabbi Herzog sent in an affidavit to explain why an Orthodox synagogue needs to have a mechitza. And they voted against the board of directors, and they said, yeah, you have to have one. So they just changed, of course, the laws of incorporation. There was another very interesting case of a chazan who was hired to daven for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur for a certain amount of money. They signed a contract, and they call him up in August, and they said, we have such good news for you. You're going to really love this news. We voted not only to take out the mechitza, but to buy a building. We just bought a church, and we renovated it, and now there's one big room with great acoustics, and it's going to be so easy for you. So he said, what are you talking about? We contracted as an Orthodox service. They said, so what? We're still Orthodox. We just don't have a mechitza. And again, there was a lawsuit that was involved, just to show you how far it went, that Orthodox congregation was just denying that we're Orthodox, and yet we don't do any of those things. And part of the reason was, and if you remember Marshall Sklar, who wrote that very famous piece, he said that by the end of the third quarter of this century, there no longer will be any Orthodox Jews in America. That was the prediction. Ben-Gurion predicted in Israel no Orthodox Jews, and Marshall Sklar, the conservative movement, reform movement, said, not in America. You're not going to have any of these Torah Jews in America. Not going to be. And it wasn't true. Torah Jews did not disappear. Orthodox Jews did not disappear. As a matter of fact, they just kept on having a lot of kids. And more Jews were born who were. And then we had other problems. In the early 1950s, Rabbi Robert Gordas, who was the head of the Halacha Commission of the Rabbinical Assembly, he came out with a responsum, which was, I have determined, together with my Halacha Commission, that driving on the Shabbat is okay, as long as you drive to shul and go home. No going to the mall, no going to the theater, no going shopping, go to shul and go home. And he said, I'm positive my people will listen to me and we're going to save Judaism by driving on the Shabbos. That was a major, major change in conservative Judaism. Major change to drive on Shabbos, which is to desecrate the Shabbos. Nobody would disagree that it's desecrating the Shabbos. Even he said it's desecrating the Shabbos. He said, but you're allowed to do it to get to shul, or else we'll lose them altogether if they don't come to shul. And then in the 1980s, perhaps the most devastating blow in terms of Jewish unity was the decision of the Reform Movement to change the thousands-year-old tradition of matrilineal descent and go to patrilineal descent, so that now, if your mother or your father is Jewish, you are Jewish. That's all you really need to do. And then you're Jewish. And that really caused even consternation in the Reconstructionist movement and in the conservative movement, but certainly for the Orthodox Jews. So we have this issue about Jewish unity, whatever that means. We'll talk about a definition, whatever that means. But we certainly have the sense that there's a rift in the Jewish community, a rift between the real offenders are the Orthodox. The Torah Jews are the real offenders because everybody else is willing to compromise. If you remember Gunter Plaut, a very famous Reform rabbi, he said, look, he was speaking to Ismar Thorsch of the seminary, and he said, look, I'm a man of compromise. I'm willing, and today's Lent, so it makes a lot of sense to talk about it. I'm willing to give up something very, very religiously important to me. I'll make that concession, but you've got to give up something that's important to you as well. And he said, I will give up eating lobster. But what I'm... You know, you people are too judgmental. This is what he said. I'll give up if you give a major concession. And Is Moshe Rosh Hashanah? Well, we're not ready to make that concession yet.
They
should eventually
have given it up also.
What?
They should have given up eating out lobster also.
At that time, they were not allowed to, and they're still not allowed to. So they're not allowed. They're not whatever. You know, come on. That's why we have Jewish disunity, because of some. You have to say the truth. The truth is the truth. So that to go past this phase, that's really just the basic history. So the idea is that the internal beliefs of the various denominations of Judaism divide. That creates a tremendous rift. But we came up with something, at least in the past 50 years, that works for us, which is external threats unite. Internally, but externally, we have enough threats against us, Baruch Hashem, that we can be united, and we have a united front. And those external crises, of course, are very compelling, because one value that's shared by all Jews is survival. All of us want to survive. It's elemental to the human species, and certainly to the Jewish people. We want to survive, and want to survive as a Jewish nation. And therefore, we developed a lot of organizations in the last 50 years that unite the Jewish people. You have the Anti-Defamation League. We're all united against anti-Semitism. We're all united against Holocaust denial. Holocaust also is a very wonderful Holocaust Museum, Holocaust studies, Holocaust programs, also very, very important in terms of Jewish unity. Kill 6 million Jews, but can get together and talk about it. Anti-Semitism, kill Jews in France. It's something that's meaningful to all Jews. We can come together and we can protest. You also have the AJC and many of these organizations. Some of them just don't really exist much anymore, but we know similar kinds of organizations, and all of them, AIPAC now is one of the biggest organizations. I was at the conference last year, over 15,000 Jews of every stripe, from the secular to the Hasidic, that were there, 15,000 strong, because Israel, for many, many people, unites all of the Jews together. Our problem, of course, is that many Jews are no longer agitated by anti-Semitism. There were groups of people, part of J Street, that when they had the murders in France, while they lamented it, not a good thing to murder people. Terrorism is not a great thing. But they understood that the real reason that was happening is because of the occupation in Israel. Because of the fact that the Jews are Nazi-like in their approach to the Palestinians. And many Jews no longer were going to protest that kind of anti-Semitism. Israel is no longer a unifying force. We know from the Pew Report that the people who are in the 30s and millennials and younger, they no longer support Israel. They really support the Palestinian cause. And we know that from the BDS, many of the leaders are Jews, and we know that from J Street, many of the people are really, really not together with the state of Israel. And we're no longer, as a nation, we're no longer agitated by historical issues. But one thing that does agitate us, meaning a new battle cry, the new battle cry is pluralism. Pluralism is very, very important. As a matter of fact, President Obama said that our environment is the number one threat. In Judaism, the number one rallying point that will bring us together is pluralism. Now, exactly what does that mean? And the battle cry is, don't stifle pluralism. Just as a matter of fact, just this week, Sharansky, together with Netanyahu, they created a compromise at the Kotel, which was pluralistic. And they have a whole large swath of land, and they're going to build it up so that everybody will be comfortable in their religious practices and their rituals. And that's a very good... And part of the rallying cry is, anti-Semites don't make any distinctions between observant Jews and not observant Jews and secular Jews. And Hitler didn't really care about what your affiliation was when he threw you into the ovens, which happens to be true. It happens to be very, very true. Arabs don't care who you are when they send the rockets in. They'll kill anybody who's a Jew, anybody who's an Israeli. And therefore, the argument is if we share a common fate, then we should behave as an indivisible people. And the indivisibility is, you do what you want to do, and I'll do what I want to do, and you keep quiet. And sometimes I'm going to ask you to do something you don't want to do, and for the sake of unity, you have to do it. And that's the issue And that is the situation. Now, everybody likes to talk about Jewish unity, which must mean, I'm just using a Cartesian argument, that if we can talk about Jewish unity, it must mean that if in theory it exists, so the question that we have to answer is, well, so then why doesn't it exist? Why doesn't Jewish, it sounds very good, we'd like to hear about it, we'd like to talk about it, so then why doesn't it exist? And the truth is, if you go back in all of Jewish history, you will find that Jewish unity was achieved only once in all of our history. Only once. There were people for thousands of years. And it happened in the Sinai Desert. And it happened in the year 2448 from the creation of the world. And the Torah, the Bible, speaks about it. It says, Vayichan Yisrael Neger, the Jewish people, all rested opposite the Mount Sinai. And it should have said, and they, Vayachanu, it doesn't say Vayachanu, it says Vayichan. And Rashi, citing the words of the rabbis, tells us that they were Ke'ishecha, Bolevecha, that they were unified in purpose, like one person. That's why it was in the singular, because they had Levecha. And that was the idea. The idea was, if you share the same common goal, if you share the same destiny, well, then that's what unifies you. That's what makes you a single nation. And we're very far from that today. We're very far from Sinai, and we're very far from that kind of unity, which is that we no longer share a common religion. We have gone so far from the source that we just don't have the same religion. If you would ever read, I'm not telling you that you should, but if you would read Reform theology, that's not threatening, theology, you would see that, and the polls that were taken among Reform rabbis, that many Reform rabbis do not believe, not in a traditional God, they do not believe even in a pantheistic God. They just don't believe in a God. They don't have a God idea that they believe in. If you read, let's say, in Emet ve'Emunah, which is the manifesto of the conservative movement, they will tell you, I don't know if you ever read the book I'm referring to? There is a real fast. In the late 80s, in the conservative movement themselves, they were going through divisions. And it came to a head, so that all of the various organizations that make up, that comprise five organizations that comprise the conservative movement, they got together and they made their own think tank of rabbis and lay people, etc., men and women, and they said, "What does it mean to be a conservative Jew? Like, how do you know if you're a conservative Jew? And you haven't slipped into Reform or Reconstructionist or God forbid, Orthodox. How would you know? How would you know?" So they had this manifesto. And they did it in the form of the 13 principles of the Rambam. The Rambam has 13 affirmations of the faith. And what they did is they went for all 13. And they say there's a range of what you can believe and what you can avow and still be a conservative Jew. And they give you, the first one is God. Well, they say there's a traditional view of God, etc. And there's an idea that wherever there's goodness and justice in the world, that's God, that's the range. And if you believe any of those things, in the three that they give you in the middle, you're a conservative Jew. And they go through all of them. The interesting thing is, one of those principles of the faith, which is probably the most important of all of them, is revelation that God gave a Torah at Sinai. What's interesting is, in the Emet ve'Emunah, the conservative movement, it's the only one of the 13 principles where they do not give you the choice to believe that God revealed himself at Sinai to the Jewish people. It's the only one that they don't even give you the choice. That's because they believe in, it's a whole other topic, they believe in something called continuous revelation. They believe in something called continuous revelation, which means that the cumulative knowledge and progress of the world, all of that is prophecy, because they don't believe in traditional prophecy. And therefore, in one of the big airs they had, they say, Akiba knew more than Moses, and we know more than Akiba, because of the cumulative knowledge of the ages, we know more. In other words, everything is cumulative. So that's a major difference between Reform Some don't even believe in God. Revelation is not even a possibility. And the conservative movement, where to be a conservative Jew, you don't even have a choice. You don't have even a choice. Because that's intellectually challenging to believe that God revealed himself to human beings. And then you have Orthodox Judaism, which believes that God revealed himself 100%. We don't have a range. We believe it. It says so in the Torah. That's exactly what they believe. And therefore, religiously, there's very little in common that traditional Jews, Torah Jews, have with the other denominations. The closest, I'm going to say something that will sound ridiculous, but the closest religion, denomination that we have that's close to us is Reconstructionism. That's closer to us than conservative and reform, theologically. Because what do they believe? They believe in dialogic Judaism, something similar to Buber's existential relationships, the I eternal thou relationships. These are all interesting things for your reading pleasure. But they believe in God gave all six, whatever God means, but there were 613 precepts. If any of these precepts is meaningful to you, if it talks to you, if it speaks to you, then you ought to do it. That's the phrase of Kaplan. You ought to do it. That's a deontologically rather than utilitarian ethic. If it speaks to you, then you ought to do it. If it doesn't speak to you, then you don't. I was once the acquaintance of the Reconstructionist rabbi in White Plains. He converted to Orthodoxy and he made Aliyah. But I remember when he was a Reconstructionist rabbi, and I met him and his wife. And what was amazing to me is that his wife kept kosher because it spoke to her. And he didn't. It didn't speak to him. But he kept Shabbos like an Orthodox Jew, and Shabbos didn't speak to her at all. And they had this kind of a relationship where he kept some of the mitzvos, not many, and she kept some of the mitzvos, not many, and yet they were able to coexist. Well, so together, betwixt them both, they licked the bladder clean. So they had a whole bunch of mitzvos between them. But after a while, they became so confused that what really spoke to them, speaks to me a lot, speaks to me a little, they decided, just do it all. And they actually, they went through a very interesting couple. They're doing very well in Israel. He's a professor who changed his career from rabbi and now teaches physics. She changed her career. She's a psychologist. Very interesting couple. And the kids have payas, just to show you how far I went. And they're traditional Jews. But the idea is, I always appreciate Reconstructionism because it gives you the opportunity to perform the mitzvahs if they speak to you. Be that as it may, let's continue. We no longer have a shared literature. It used to be that the Torah, even if you had different opinions, the Torah united you. We no longer even have most Jews, this is from the Pew report that came out 2 years ago, most Jews have no idea what it says in the Bible. If you would ask, and they did, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, most Jews had no idea who Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob was. In Israel, when they did a poll, they found that most Jews, secular Jews, did not know what a mezuzah was. It's shocking. Not a mezuzah. Well, if they never went to a Jewish home, the answer is no, they didn't. So there's a very, very great gap. We no longer share that common literature. You know, speak about Jewish disunity. If you remember that what took place in Tenafly, New Jersey, and it took place in the Hamptons, which was just finished this past summer. That Orthodox Jews, if you move into the Hamptons, you're a sophisticated, successful Jew. You've got to be to move into the Hamptons. And many of them did. They're like, why not? The Hamptons. And they wanted to put up an Eruv. Now, you know what an Eruv is. You can't see the Eruv. It doesn't bother anybody. It doesn't choke anybody. And they just protested. And in the deliberations, especially in Tenafly, it became vicious because the mayor was a Jew, and she was not allowing it to have the Eruv. She basically said, we don't want you here. We don't want Orthodox Jews here. We just don't want you here. You're an embarrassment to us. You walk on Saturday, you don't drive on Saturday, you wear little beanies on your head. It's embarrassment. It's just an embarrassment. That's how far the Jewish disunity has gotten. You just don't want Jews who are there. Now, in order to be unified, if you think about it, just superficially, you need to have a common goal. Now, Judaism is vast. and it's Judaism is not monolithic, and Judaism is not monochromatic, and we know that there is a tremendous diversity. And as a matter of fact, we see this in the Bible, we see this in the Torah. When Yaakov blessed his children, now how many blessings did he give? He gave 13 blessings, or at least 13 children were blessed. And before he blesses them, the Torah even tells you the unique level of those blessings. Ish kibirchato birachotam. Each according to the blessing that was proper for them. In other words, each, now we're parents, so we know that each of our children has different talents and different abilities that separate them from the other children. And we try to imbue our children with the sense that if you take those innate talents that you have and you develop them and you refine them, that's going to be the area of your success. Chanoch hanar al pi darko gam ki yasu lo yaskin. That's what King Solomon, bright man, that's what he told us to do. Teach each child according to their ability. And Yaakov blessed each one of them according to their ability. Each one of the 12 tribes were different. And they had different capacities. And therefore he blessed them according to that capacity. And if you read it, you see that. What's interesting is, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, a very great rabbi, he says, those blessings are reiterated when the Torah speaks about how the Jews traveled in the desert. Now we know when the Jews traveled in the desert, the Torah tells us that each one had their own flag. And on the flag, they had their own insignia, the coat of arms, and they each had their own color. And the color and the insignia spoke to the quality of the tribe. But Yaakov Kamenetz says, why didn't he give them that when they were in Egypt, when he blessed them? That would be like a really dramatic kind of a thing. I can even see that as a good video. He gives them the blessing and he gives them their flag. This will be your flag, my son. This is the credo by which you will live your life. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky points out, when did this happen? Only after the Torah was given. Only after the Torah was given. And he says, and that's what the Torah says. When the Torah speaks about who was going to be with whom and which flags they're going to use, it says, V'saviv la'mishkan yachanu. Everything circles the Torah. Everything circles the service of God. Everything that God told you in the Torah, that's the centrality of everything you do. Whatever unique talents you have, it's all going to be used through and enhanced by the Torah that God gave us. Without the Torah, it's really of very, very little value. And that is the idea. 13 tribes, because Ephraim and Manasseh were two boys, and that was instead of Yosef. And the interesting thing is, that's the diversity. Those 13 gentlemen had tremendously diverse powers and abilities. And yet we know that if they work together, that's achdus. They work together, that's unity. As a matter of fact, the word for unity in Hebrew is to be echad, is to be one. And the numerical Maral points out that the numerical value is echad, is 13, because that's the unity of the Jewish people. When all 13 Jews, all different, all diverse, when they work together, that's how you achieve unity. How? When you have a common goal. When it's saviv la'mishkan yachanu, when you're all working towards the same thing in your own way. Because, to quote one of the great mystical rabbis who says, God is one. Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. God is one. And even though the universe is so diverse and has thousands of insects and every possible creation, all of that came out of that one God. And the oneness of God is not compromised by the diversity of everything that He created in the universe. And therefore, oneness is the antidote to disunity. That's what the Torah is telling us. That's what the rabbis teach us. And that's what makes a lot of sense. Because if you have that goal, that is what will unify. So let's talk about what doesn't work. Let's see what people have tried to do to create unity. And we know it doesn't work because we still have not achieved unity. Now, on the one hand, every Jew who is a knowledgeable Jew and a Jew who knows anything about Judaism will acknowledge that Jewish unity and Ahavat Yisrael, Jews loving each other, are values that are deeply rooted. They're fundamental to our belief system. There's no Jew who would deny that. From the Satmar Rebbe to Rav Moshe Feinstein to anybody, any Jew on the street that will tell you, oh, you Jewish unity, Ahavat Yisrael, Kulanu Ohavim Zeh, Ikar B'Chol HaYahadut. Everybody will tell you this. That everybody's got to love each other. And it's true. And that rifts and discord and all of these kinds of battles and divisions is really inimical to the ultimate value of the Torah. The ultimate value of the Torah is, like the last blessing in the Shemona Esrei, the climax of our prayer to God, is peace. Hamavarecha Damo Yisrael b'shalom. God blesses us with peace. Peace. The Sivoseha Shalom. The whole Torah brings peace. That's the whole point of the Torah, to bring peace, to bring unity, to bring harmony, to bring equilibrium. That's what God's peace. And therefore the Torah brings peace. So obviously, you need to have Jewish unity. You need to have Jews loving each other. That's on the one hand. But on the other hand, if the price to achieve the unity results in the dilution of our eternal values, if it compromises the halakhic integrity of the traditions that we have accepted that kept Judaism alive all of these years. And I hate to go back to the Pew Report, but it's a dispassionate, impartial, objective report that was done by people who deal with statistics. And they said that the continuity of Judaism is based upon keeping the traditions. And to the extent that you keep the traditions, that is how you keep the religion alive. In all of its forms. You know, one of the things that we know, just, you know it anecdotally, and we know it historically, and we know it's just the truth. It's just unfortunately or fortunately a truth, a truism. That the one value, the one great value that most Jews have abandoned is that value that keeps Jews Jewish on any level. And that's the Shabbat, that's keeping Shabbos. And one of the great heretical Jews, Achad Ha'am, said years ago, he said, Yoter mimashi Yisrael shomer et ha-Shabbat, ha-Shabbat shomer et Yisrael. That more than the Jews keep the Shabbos keeps the Jews. And that's lost. And unfortunately, I say this unfortunately, you may not agree with me. Unfortunately, if you go to conservative temples, you will see, and this is in the Pew Report as well, but if you go, you will see that the average age in a conservative temple on Shabbos is upwards of 60. Upwards of 60. Where are the youth? They've been bar mitzvah, they've been bat mitzvah, they've had all of the pluralistic training. Where are they? The answer is unfortunately, they've abandoned everything. And now the next fight in the conservative movement is intermarriage, is assimilation, which they're giving into. They're giving into it because they don't know, what do you do? And the truth is, they've gone so far, I don't know what they should do. It's very, very difficult. Very, very difficult. And it's a sad thing because we're bleeding Jewish boys and girls out of the religion. There aren't that many Jews to begin with. And we need every single Jew. But to distort theological truths and to compromise is not something that is beneficial. It's not something that works. It's not something that helps. We can't renounce our religious principles in the face of unity. We can't do as Gunther Plaut said, you give up something important to you and I'll give up my lobster. Can't do that. You know, there was a book that was written. I won't say the name of the person. If you read the book, you'll know the name of the author. It's a very famous Orthodox rabbi. And he calls for dialogue with the church. He's been very much involved in that. He wrote a book about 6 years ago where he explained how the best approach to unity with the Jews and the Christians would be. This is what he writes. And then I'll quote you from the review of the book from the Catholic Digest. I read Catholic Digest. Important to know what people say. So he wrote something very similar to Gunther Plaut, which is there are certain concepts that are so offensive to Jews. And there are certain concepts that Jews have that are so offensive to Christians. What we need to do is, in order to achieve unity, is we need to disavow ourselves of those, what he calls, those objectionable and pernicious values. And he says, Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, is so offensive to Jews who believe in one God you've got to renounce that. And we'll renounce the Messiah, because we know that believing the Messiah didn't come is very objectionable and repulsive to you. So we'll deny the Messiah if you deny the Trinity. So in the Catholic Digest, his name was, the one who did it, was a very interesting person, James O'Connor, who happens to be a bishop. He says, what? In order to have unity with the Jews, we're going to give up our theological truths? We're going to compromise on that which is most dear to us, that we're willing to give up our lives for as good Christians? Never. Never. Even though unity with the Jews is very important to us. Ever since Vatican II, this is something that we strive for. Ich darf nicht sein Ärger wie ein Goy, wie ein Galach. Which is a different language. And that's exactly what is being asked of us. You know, in Israel now, there's a major, you know this, you read the papers, you read the Jewish Week, get all the truth. So you know there's a major conflict. The conservative reform movement want equal rights with the Orthodox in terms of conversion, in terms of marriage, in terms of divorce. They want that. It's coming to them, and they want it. Now, I'm not here to disparage what they do, but I am here to say that let's take conversion. Conversion is very important. I have a son, and I want him to get married. You know, a nice girl. I have a son, I want him to get married. But I want him to marry a Jew. And he wants to marry a Jew. He wants to marry a Jew. Now, we always, until 1984, there was never a question, that if a Reformed Jew said, I'm a Jew, they were a Jew. Conservative Jew, they said, they're a Jew. They're not observant, they're not Shomer Shabbos, they don't eat kosher, whatever it is, they drive on Shabbos, but they're Jewish. They're Jewish. Now, as far as they're concerned, they're Jewish because they're patrilineal descent. The mother is not Jewish, but the father is Jewish. And the girl says she's Jewish. So if you meet this girl on J-date, as many of our children meet their intended on J-date, or the cooler websites, and they have the religion, and she puts down Jewish. And you meet her, you go out with her, take her out for a few drinks, you go to the club a few times. She's wonderful. I love her. This girl, Christine, she's Jewish, but I love her. And it turns out she's not Jewish. That's called unity. Is that something we can... Okay, so what's the difference? A goya here and a goya here. So it depends on a yid. That's what they're asking us to do. Make just, for the sake of unity, make believe she's Jewish. For the sake of Ahavat Yisrael. That's what you need to do. Very interesting. I think that some of you were there. It's just a few weeks ago. The UJA Federation had a major meeting in Bethel, and the guest speaker was Rabbi David Stav. Any of you there? You're too religious. You wouldn't go. Okay. Ich bin ein Rishagitz. I was there. So I found it interesting and sad. So Rabbi David Stav is the head of a group of rabbis, very liberal Orthodox rabbis in Israel called Tzohar, which means the enlightened ones, the real rabbis. And they say that the traditional rabbis are bad people. Well, they're traditional, they don't look good, they don't talk good. Okay, we're the enlightened rabbis, okay? And we're tolerant and we're open and we're willing to work with everybody. Okay, fantastic. The head of that group is Rabbi David Stav. So UJA Federation flew him in from Israel to go from city to city for the UJA Federation to show that it's unity. And that way they can be able to raise money for Israel. They have a major campaign to raise money for job training in Israel. But nobody wants to give money for Israel because they boycott Israel because you don't recognize our conversions, you don't recognize our marriages. We don't have rights like Orthodox rabbis, we don't give me a penny. So they try to battle that. So Rabbi David Stav is there. And he speaks very sweetly and speaks very nicely, very impressive. He's tall, he's handsome. He's wearing a beautiful suit, beautiful tie, crisp shirt. I mean, very impressive. Rabbi should look good. He was very, very impressive. And he's talking. I'm saying to myself, I love this guy. You know, the woman next to me, she said, oh, I love this guy. Everybody loves this guy. Question and answer time. Lady raises her hand. She's wearing a kippah. I'm a Reform rabbi. Very nice talk, Rabbi Stock. Beautiful talk. Oystikishin. Beautiful talk. How come I can't marry somebody in Israel? You're so tolerant and you see all different points of view and unity. Would you recognize my marriage? If I would marry somebody, do you recognize them as marriage? If I convert somebody, would I be able to be part of your Beit Din to convert somebody? That's a pointed question. Now, what's he supposed to say? Now, I felt sorry for the rabbi, but I wasn't standing up there. Now, what do you say? Let me tell you what I would have said. Sweetly and nicely, I'm not as tall as him, as handsome as him, but I would have said in my sweetest voice, you know, Rabbi Jane, I'm an Orthodox rabbi. We follow the traditions of our forefathers. We have a Torah, we have Mishnah, we have Talmud, we have Gaonim, we have Rishonim, we have a Shulchan Aruch, a code of Jewish law, and we have Jewish traditions that we've been following for thousands of years. And in my court, we use those same rules in conversion. In marriage, we use the same rules that they used 100, 200, 300, 1,000 years ago. You don't use those rules. It's not a personal kind of a thing, but no, we don't consider that marriage following the tradition and following the code of Jewish law. We don't consider that a conversion. That's what I would have said, sweetly and nicely. But he knew that wouldn't work. So what did he say? Could you imagine what he said? He said, well, and I saw that as he said it, he was sorry he said it. But once you say it, you can't take it back. You learned that from Donald Trump. Once you say it, you can't take it back. But he doesn't care. And he said, you know, the reason is because there aren't that many Reform Jews in Israel. If you would have a whole bunch of Reform Jews coming to Israel, the answer would be yes. No, that's not true. And the Reform rabbi and the lady next to me, who turned out also to be Reform, not a rabbi, but Reform, everybody knew he wasn't saying the truth. Everybody knew that he was just, and he did himself a tremendous amount of damage. He did damage to Jewish unity. And what I learned that night, because he taught me a great lesson, which is people, they may yell, they may jeer, they may say negative things, but they respect principle, they respect integrity. If you say, I follow the traditions of my forefathers and I'm not going to compromise and I see no reason to compromise and I'm sorry if it offends you. I don't mean to offend you. I just mean to keep the traditions alive and well. I work for God, not for you. People respect it. They don't like it, but they respect it. And they don't respect when you don't say the truth. They don't respect when you compromise. And I think that's a very, very important thing that Torah Jews have to realize. Because we get intimidated. You know, and I think the reason we get intimidated, especially rabbis, I got to say that. We get it. Me too. I'm a rabbi. We get intimidated. People are like, Jewish unity, Jewish unity. Why are we so intimidated? And I think it's our Torah Jews. I think it's our Achilles heel. And I think the reason is because the truth, the reality is, the real down-to-earth, 100% bona fide reality is that we do love all Jews. We don't. Our love is not at all guided if they're traditional, if they're observant. The truth is that because we have a tradition of our Torah, which is all Jews are part of one family. All Jews are the same. These labels are fake. They're fake. I have a next-door neighbor who's Reform. So she was explaining to me on Yom Kippur that her husband wants to walk to Temple Israel. She says, it's over a mile. But I'm Reform. I'm Reform. He's Reform. We're allowed to drive on Yom Kippur. We're allowed to. Could you please explain that to my husband? Give me my word. Give me my word. That's what the labels do. That's what the labels do. The labels, they're artificial. The word Orthodox was actually a pejorative label given to traditional Jews by the Reform Jews. Because Orthodox means you don't move. Like orthoprax. You don't move. Like orthopedic. You just don't yield. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's not my Torah. The Torah doesn't belong to us to compromise. There's no rabbi, there's no anybody. It's not his Torah. What we need to do is we need to observe the Torah, and we need to hand it down to the next generation the way it was given to us. That's our job. Nothing more and nothing less. You know, and they point to, if you ever have a debate with a conservative reform rabbi, they'll always say, well, you know, what you're saying is not really Jewish tradition. I'm learned. What about Shammai and Hillel? They're constantly disputing certain laws. And what does the Talmud say about their disputes? The Talmud, I know even the Hebrew. Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim. These and those are the words of the living God. Judaism doesn't have one way of looking at things. There's Shammai, there's Hillel, and there's Reform, and there's Conservative. Why can't you see that? And the answer is, it's a good question, but the answer is, if it's not the word of the living God, so then you can't say this is the word of the living God. These people don't believe, many of them don't believe in God. And those who believe in God don't believe that God gave this Torah. So what are they? What kind of excuses? It's not the same. It has to be Elohim Chayim. You have to believe that God gave the Torah, and you actually have to know the Torah to be able to have an opinion. And this is what unnerves and makes Jews, Orthodox Jews, very, very insecure. Because we don't want to have fights with other Jews. We love other Jews. We really have, deep down, tremendous Ahavat Yisrael for Jews. And that's why we're so sensitive. I want to just end with what really is the solution to Jewish unity. And we will have it. Because we have a guarantee from our prophets that it will take place. I only wish I could tell you when. But it will take place. We have a tradition. It's a song. Anything that's a Jewish song is a true tradition. And that it's a tradition that comes from the Zohar. Zohar is a nice book. Hard to read, but it's a nice book. And in the Zohar, it says it at least four times. Yisrael, the Oraita, the Kudsha Brichu Chadhu, the Jewish people, and the Torah, and God are one. Don't tell me it sounds like the Trinity. Yisrael, the Oraita, the Kudsha Brichu Chadhu. This triad is telling us that God is one, the Jewish people is one. We say this every Shabbos afternoon. But the way that we achieve that unity is with the Torah in the center. Yisrael, v'oraisa v'kutcha b'chacharu. That is the only answer to Jewish unity, because the Torah bonds Jews together. It's the center link. And that's something that we need to be more mindful of. And the way that we achieve, meaning that Orthodox Jews achieve Jewish unity, is to create in ourselves the urge to reach out to other Jews. We don't have that urge to reach out. The truth is, we have the urge to insulate ourselves, because it's dangerous out there, which is true. So we have to resist the urge to withdraw, because in fact, even though to people who are not traditional Jews, it sounds very condescending. It sounds very paternalistic. If you would quote what real Jewish law and Jewish outlook is, the vast majority of the people that we're speaking about are non-traditional. They have a halachic category, which is known as tinok shenishba. They're people who did not have the benefit of Jewish education. They did not have the benefit of being brought up in homes that taught them the beauty of a Shabbos. The beauty of Shabbos candles, of a family sitting together and eating in a holy meal every single Friday night. They just didn't have that. They didn't have the benefit of learning our Torah and learning Jewish traditions and the beauty of the Jewish texts and the beauty of everything that we do that makes us Jews, that really gives us a sense of the divine and gives us a sense of the eternal. And I want to just end with a word of one of the really great rabbis who lived in the 16th century. His name was Rabbi Moshe Kotavero. Usually people know him as the Ramak. Rabbi Moshe Kotavero wrote a number of books. One of his famous books is called Tomer Devorah, where he goes through the attributes that we're supposed to emulate in God. There are 13 attributes of mercy which we're supposed to emulate. And he goes through them. One of the things that he says, which I think is beautiful, he says, and I translate into English, hope that's okay. He says, all Jews are part of one family. And there is a piece of every Jew in every other Jew. Gene, it means there's a piece of you in me. That's what it means. Janet, there's a piece of me in you. Hope it doesn't hurt. It's a fact, he says. It's a fact. And our challenge, and it's a challenge to traditional Jews, because we're fortunate that we have all of that knowledge, we have all of that tradition, we have all of those observances which elevate us, and that we love, and that we cherish, and we're constantly in a state of trying to become more involved in these precepts, more involved, more holy, more spiritual, more kadosh. That's what we try to do. We strive to do that. Everybody in their own way and everybody in their own pace. So our challenge is to see every single Jew as our brother and our sister. And if somebody's your brother and somebody's your sister, you care about them. You love them. No matter what they do, you care about them and you love them. And also, if they know it or they don't know it, every Jew is our partner in a common mission, because we do have a common mission. And the truth is that no Jew is able to divest himself, not for long, from that common mission. And that mission is, although this has been perverted, but we say this every day, three times a day, without perversion, L'takein olam b'malchut shakai. To make the world a godly place. That's our mission. And that's the only way that can be done is through Torah. It's the only way. It's the only way. Now, if we want to look for models of how this is to be done, the kind of mindset that you need, and the kind of ability that you need, and the desire, all you need to do is to look to Rabbi Zaitchik and Rabbi Simcha Blumer Zaitchik. That's all you've got to do. Because they have the urge not to withdraw, they have the urge to reach out. And they know, and they live this way. And I know so many Jews that they made. I know so many. So many. How do they do it? With love. With love, but more. But love is not enough. Jews for Jesus have love also, v'havdol. By always giving the authentic Torah message. With sweetness and with goodness and with patience, but always with authenticity. Never apologetic. Always trying to explain. Always trying to make it relevant, to make it meaningful. And all of you here know how relevant and how meaningful the Torah is, and Judaism is, and real Judaism is, and Torah Judaism is. And we have the ability. You got that from Rabbi. You may not be able to do it as good as Rabbi Zaitchik. Few people can. Few people can do it as Rabbi Simcha Blumer Zaitchik. But everybody has the ability to do it. You just need a smile. You need to care a lot. And you need to know it's your brother, it's your sister, it's a common mission. And the faster we get our act together and we do it, then Hamavareches Amo Yisrael Bashalom, the climax of all of our prayers is that God, because God wants that. God's name is Shalom. God's name is peace. The Torah is peace. So we need to create that peace. We need to create that environment, that atmosphere. That's the real, true answer to Jewish unity. And that's a challenge. So I'm leaving everybody with a challenge. But I want to thank you very much for listening. Almost nobody fell asleep.